Okay, so this is Ink Studs, CITR 101.9 FM. My guest today is Robert Gooden, whose new book, The Man Who Loved Breasts, is a fine journey into one man's, industry of choice, one might say. Flip book with George Olavetia?
Olavetia.
Amputee, yeah. Fetishist. And if that was the first thing someone had read by you, you could easily be pegged pretty quick.
Yes.
But I don't think it's accurate, except, of course, if people have only read that in Moam, and then the story you have in Moam about the woman with the extra leg. Three-legged Myrna and her two lovers. So.
Yeah, that would be another one. Similar.
And then there's the story of you hiding in your wife's bottom as well.
Yeah. So. And the fart of love for Project Romantic.
Oh, I forgot to...
Another.
I didn't read that recently.
Yeah.
A while ago.
Read all of those, I may seem rather one-dimensional, perhaps.
But you're not.
No, I hope not.
So tell me a bit about yourself. Give me a background of who is Robert Gooden.
Well, I went to college and majored in illustration. And when I got out of college, I wanted to make a living. So I tried to get into animation, which was a little harder than I thought it would be. But I eventually got a full-time job in animation at Klasky Chupo that made Rugrats. And my first show I worked on was Duckman, Wild Thornberries. So I did that, but my passion was really to do comics, but I knew that comics was not going to be something that I could just jump into and pay the rent.
Yeah.
And also, I knew there was going to be a significant learning curve there, since I'd never really drawn a comic. It was going to take a while. So while I was in animation, after about maybe 6 months, I started to look at that more. It was sort of my goal to do that part-time, and so I began to do that. The first thing I did was with a friend of mine on Duckman called Hot Mexican Love Comics, a little anthology that our fellow animation people chipped in money, all of us, like, I think it was $30 a page, if you did a page or two pages, to cover the printing costs. And so we put that out, and it was a good experience to learn how all of it works, you know, the distributing, printing. And then I got more involved into it, starting my own little publishing company for a while, continuing with the animation thing. And I've been pretty much juggling all of that ever since, trying to do comics when I can, trying to make a living. I think that has generally been the constant struggle I have, is wanting to be a full-time cartoonist, comic artist, and... Just knowing that that's not going to come anytime soon, if ever, and trying to keep all this stuff in balance and continue to draw comics.
What were some of your influences that drew you into comics?
Back in the early days, when I was a kid, I was into superhero comics. So, and that was when I was a kid, I wanted to draw superhero comics.
Mm-hmm.
So people like George Perez, John Byrne, Marshall Rogers, those guys of the 80s. And then David Mazzucchelli blew me away when he started Daredevil and Batman. And then as the interest in superheroes started to wane, in college discovering 8-Ball, and I think the thing that really knocked me out was Raw, finding the digest issues of that as Raw was starting to come to an end. That was the first time I was exposed to a lot of Europeans like Jacques Tardy. The first time I saw Charles Burns, Gary Panter, you know, all of those guys. And I think that really opened up the door to what was possible.
Oh, there's so many fantastic folks in those books. Like, it's, you won't see something like that nowadays, except for the occasional, little snippet. But just, yeah, the cross, I guess, section of folks from Tardy to Deitch to Byrne story, and they're all just classic seminal strips too.
Yeah, amazing. Still amazing. I wish there's a lot of them that I don't have. I've got some of the early ones, but I can't imagine. There's probably a ton of stuff in there that I've not yet read. Jose Munoz, coming across his stuff in there. It's just... Remember Cowboy Hank? I haven't seen any of that in a long time.
Cowboy
Do you remember that?
Hank, no.
Oh, God, just weird stuff. That really got me going. And then I think shortly after that, some stuff from the kind of the post-90s European Revolution from L'Association kind of started to trickle in. And I went to Angoulême right after, or actually right before I published Odin in 1998, I think.
Oh, wow.
And then that was another mind-blowing experience, seeing all of these other publishers and that whole generation of amazing cartoonists over there. So, yeah.
I could just see that being just kind of a overly, like, I guess, sense-shattering experience coming from the, the American West Coast style to this massive, overwhelming complex of churches and whatnot.
Oh, yeah, at Angoulême?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I couldn't... Well, when I went there the first time, in 98, comics were sort of starting to get accepted in the mainstream a little bit, but it was still pretty ghetto industry.
Yeah.
And going to Angoulême and seeing in every storefront posters of comics, like, it takes over the whole little small town there. In my hotel, which was outside of the town, seeing posters all over the hallway, I thought I had died and gotten to comic heaven. I couldn't believe that such a place existed. It was just mind-blowing. Oh. And it's still mind-blowing. Every time I go there, there's some sort of life-changing experience that happens. I really love it. But yeah, at the time, and to think, you know, I had known Fantagraphics guys, Drawn and Quarterly, and I knew what was going on in North America, and to see that there was just as big of a movement going on in Europe that I had just really a smallest bit of knowledge about, and to be exposed to it all at once, like in a day, was crazy. It was a really amazing experience.
So
I would recommend anybody, if you can go to Angoulême at some point, to go, because there's still a ton of artists that have not yet been translated over here, which is a shame. But it's getting better with every year.
Oh, I know. I see plenty of stuff. And I even know of some folks that are from North America that are getting their stuff published there before getting published here. So,
wow.
Yeah, I think you'll be seeing some cool stuff coming out in a while from some swell folks. Now, so when did you start publishing robot publishing comics?
That was in... the first book came out, Odin, in 98. That was after we did Hot Mexican Love Comics, and I sort of got the gist of how the whole thing works. I thought I would fund something on my own, because we didn't act as an editor at all on Hot Mexican Love Comics. If people paid, then they were in. and so we had all, you know, the gamut of crazy material in there.
Some good, some bad, some crazy.
Yeah. And we had some painful learning experiences. The first third of the book, I think, is printed in reverse order. We were learning quite a bit. So I decided I would take my own money, act as an editor, and the people who sort of, for whatever reason, appealed to me from Hot Mexican Love Comics, who had like a sort of a vision that I could identify with, I asked them to try something more ambitious, and we took about a year and a half working on it, and put out this bigger anthology, Odin, that was 9x12, and I was hoping I would put it out, and it would be something, you know, it was inspired by the Drone and Quarterly anthologies, and Raw, And I was hoping that, it would be this kind of newer generation and we would go out and be warmly accepted, but it tanked.
Oh.
And I think it, there's a lot of reasons probably why it tanked, but one reason, it was very expensive to make, and it had an $18 price tag, and the only artist in there that anybody's ever heard of was Everett Peck, who created Duckman, let us run his book in there. So I think it was a lot to ask.
Yeah.
And it cost me so much money to make it that I couldn't possibly make another. Like, I think in the best circumstances, it takes a while for any book to find its audience, and I just shot my wad with that one thing. I mean, I just couldn't do another thing like that. So I then decided that I would do a bunch of smaller books that would be cheaper to produce and with only a $2 cover price, thinking that if anybody was even remotely interested in them, they would buy them. And so I printed some of those, and those also kind of tanked. And it was because retailers didn't want to carry these little books. They were like
mini-minis.
Yeah, they were like the size of an 8.5 by 11 folded into quarters, I guess.
Yeah.
And they were sort of inspired by the Pat de Mouche books that L'Association did. They were also small, and I think those were two color. But there was, you know, retailers didn't know where to put them. I guess the time really was not right for these things, because all the comic stores in America are built with the same size rack, standard comic size things, and so that didn't do very well either. And then Diamond, after I solicited two issues through Diamond, they didn't want to carry me anymore. And if Diamond doesn't carry you, then you're
yep.
done. And so
the monopoly.
Or very close to it. And so there was really not much else I could do. I spent a ton of money, I was in some debt, and I was also realizing that being a full-time person in the animation industry, publishing, and being a cartoonist, I couldn't possibly have these three careers going at once, so one would have to go. So I started to focus more on drawing my own comics, and that's what I've been trying to do ever since.
Thank you.
What do you use for your drawing? Because it feels like kind of like Lush penciling.
That,
or at least the older stuff.
It's a brush pen, but the pencil aspect comes from the lines get very, very thin. For a while, I was printing them as a grayscale image, and so the edges of those lines would sort of fade out a little bit instead of being sharp. And so since then, on my last Mom story and on The Man Who Loved Breasts, I scanned it and printed it as a very high-resolution bitmap image.
Yeah.
And so the lines are a lot more crisp, and hopefully it looks more like ink now, and the blacks are richer.
Yeah.
But I've talked to people who like that sort of wispier look to my older stuff, but it always kind of bugged me. It didn't really look like the actual pages looked, and now I think it's closer to how it's intended.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what drew me to your stuff myself. Like, I was the local comic store, Lucky's Comics in Vancouver on Main Street. I came across one of your minis, and I just, like, the really drawn in, just the whole drawing style. It's like, I think it was the pigs missing poo. And then I had, you know, I really enjoyed it. And then when you sent me the package of stuff and there was a copy of that in there, I was like, oh, yeah. I loved it.
Thank you.
Well, and it made someone in Vancouver happy because I always give away my doubles. So how did you get sucked into, I guess there's a couple of the things you're published by. You got the Moam. And I'm also curious, McSweeney's, the prestigious company. Publishing book, I guess. Because you were in... I forget which McSweeney's book, but you were in a McSweeney's.
Yeah, I forget which issue it was. It was one of the less lavishly printed ones. It's like a paperback. And that one... That was a great experience. I've wanted to do illustration, but the jobs don't come practically ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I got an email out of the blue from the editor at McSweeney's asking me to do this, and I thought it was a joke, because I don't get anything, you know, and to have McSweeney's just contact me like that was like too good to be true, because that would, you know, that'd be like a dream to do something for them. And I think that he came across my work because he referenced something that nobody had seen, but I had on Comic Art Collective, which is a website where a bunch of cartoonists sell their original art.
Yeah.
And I had some stuff on there, and so he had referenced this drawing on there. So I think that he probably went to that site just browsing,
looking at Jaime Hernandez and Dan Klaus.
Yeah,
and...
yeah, great artists. Tony Millionaire, I think, is on there. Jordan Crane.
Pete Bagg.
It's great.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Pete Bagg, Johnny Ryan.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's like very good company. So, it appeared that he found me through there, and he contacted me and asked me if I would want to illustrate these stories, and of course I would want to do that. And so, he had one story in mind for me, which was, I read and I immediately loved it. You know, after storyboarding for a bunch of years on kids' cartoons, I am used to not being excited about what I have to illustrate, sort of. Put it politely, there's a lot of terrible stories on cartoons. And to get these stories that were fantastic and really inspiring, it was great. And so the one that he had in mind for me, I read, and it was like... Like, he was a really good editor in being able to make that sort of connection. Because I read it and I thought, yeah, I agree. I think I would be well suited for this. And it was a great story, very mysterious and odd. And then he sort of would give us, he probably did this for all the illustrators, other stories that you could kind of choose from, like whichever ones grabbed you. And so I did three other ones. And he wanted us not to do any figures in it. It was like scenes of backgrounds, to do 12 sort of background illustrations that would be linked together like a comic page in a way. And so it was 12 little drawings for four stories. It was like 48 little pen and ink drawings. And it was a great experience. It was a lot of work, but like I said before, these stories are really inspiring, and it was nice to sink my teeth into them.
And
it was one of those dream jobs.
And nice to be in McSweeney's.
Yeah, that's certainly something I thought, like, all right, that's something when I'm an old man I can say I accomplished something in life.
We all have that goal, to have something that we can look back on and reminisce upon.
And, yeah, it's a great thing.
And then, so your other thing is you're in Moam. I guess you're in two issues so far, right? Am I right?
I think I'm in three.
Okay.
There's
the one story, the, I guess, Indian parable.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's two, and the third one is coming out in the spring.
Oh, okay.
I believe. Yeah, there was that three-legged Myrna, and then there was an Indian fable called The Ten Fools, and then the next one is a three-pager called Living Like a Pig, which I think is going to be in issue 14.
I think they're issue 12 right now, and 13's coming out any day, so that would be the...
Yeah, a little while.
Yeah. Tell us about the stories in the Moams.
The first one was... I had sort of gotten to know Eric a little bit over the years at conventions, and I think there was this great email list called Comic At that he was a part of, where people would just discuss comic stuff that sort of fizzled out a little while ago. So I got to know Eric a little bit, and this, I had never even considered an erotic comic. I didn't really like most erotic comics.
Mm-hmm.
But this idea came to me, and Eric was doing Dirty Stories at the time, and I thought, well, maybe this would be something that would be appropriate for Dirty Stories, so I sent it to him, and he held on to it for a while, and he was going to put it in Dirty Stories, and then Dirty Stories, whatever the last issue was going to be, didn't come out. And so then he contacted me about putting it in Moam, and I was very excited about that. So he ran that in there, and then I wanted to do other stuff in Moam, and I had these Indian fables. It's kind of a long story. I did one, The Monkey and the Crocodile, for the Swiss publisher years ago, in an anthology called Biel Noir, and the publisher is Atrabile, and then I put it in a Top Shelf anthology a little while after that. And so I had done this one fable, and I was in France for a little while trying to figure out a way to make a living, and I talked to a publisher there about doing an entire book of fables from India. So I had roughed all of these out, and then the project fell apart. And I still like these stories, and so I cleaned one of them up, and so Eric published that one, The Ten Fools. And another one is in Operation Shampooing called Moon Lake, about the elephants and the rabbits. And then the last one is what's going to be in there in a few months. Oh, can you hear me? There's a very large,
yep.
Or actually two chairs being rolled behind me. Sorry about that.
Oh, no worries.
I'm going to cross the street because more chairs are coming.
Robert's currently suffering from a chair parade taking him down.
Yeah. Who would have thought that chairs could be so loud?
It's the oddest things you'll see in a urban core.
Okay. I think that should be a little bit better.
That'll be our song break.
Okay. There.
You're joining us on Ink Studs with Robert Gooden. We're discussing Indian fables. There we go.
Yeah, so the last one will be in Moam in issue 14.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's great to be in Moam too. It's quite an honor.
It's a fine mix.
Yeah. There's a lot of good stuff. It seems to be getting better and better, and they keep throwing in like David Bay and Louis Trondheim and.
Oh, that Trondheim story was incredible.
Yeah.
It was. Yeah. The oddest thing, but it was so good. I loved it.
Yeah, it's great. So I hope they do more of that. That's a good combination of established Europeans and
lots of folks that we don't know.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm certainly thankful for that because I'm one of those folks.
So, what was the choice with doing The Man Who Loved Brass? Your new book for Top Shelf.
Like how that came about?
Yeah, and I'm curious because it's a quote unquote floppy.
I came up with the story as sort of a joke. I was joking to my wife about that would be a great job, sort of tongue in cheek, for most straight males.
Maybe tell people what the job is.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry. I'll explain it really quickly. It's about a guy who has a dead end job in the early 60s, who isn't exactly advancing in it. And he's frustrated, not very happy, it's not very fulfilling in any way. And he has a bit of a crisis, and he wants to move out of it, but he doesn't know what to do. And he's heard that really part of the secret of happiness in life is to make a living doing what you love. But he doesn't really have any passions in life, and so he's trying to figure this out. And then it dawns on him that ever since he was around 12 years old that he's really been interested in women's breasts. And so he figures out that he will become a custom bra manufacturer. But he won't do the actual manufacturing. He'll do all the measuring so that he'll be around boobs all day long.
Yeah.
So he takes off from there, and it's a bit of a rise and fall story. And intended to be sort of a little bit of a thing where any guy could relate to that fantasy a little bit.
Yeah.
And hopefully any woman can read it and see some truth into how ridiculous men can be.
But he's not sleazy. Like, there's a certain honor in what he does.
Yeah, I didn't want it. That was part of the objective, was to... Can I do this without the guy being sleazy? Because when I first told my wife about it, she didn't really like the idea and thought that it would be sleazy. And I wanted it to be something that women could enjoy, because there's a lot of stuff out there about sex written by men for men that I think women wouldn't enjoy at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to do something about sex, although it's really not very sexual even.
It's not at all.
It's kind of weird. But something that women could not only not be creeped out by, but could also enjoy it just as much as men. Because, I mean, guys, you know, it's ridiculous when you think about just guys. Guys could be talking about the most serious subject in the world, but if a topless woman were to walk into the room, they wouldn't even remember their own name. And I think that's funny.
Yeah.
And so I think women find that funny, too. And it's just the way we are. So I tried to just make a story that would have a good laugh at it, I hope it succeeded.
Now, is this?
Sorry. Go ahead.
Is this going to be an ongoing thing of short kind of story comics?
Weird sort of sexual things?
No, not necessarily have to be sexual, but short story comics from Top Shelf like this one.
Oh, you know, I don't think so. Although if they wanted to, I have about 30 pages of these Indian fables done now, and they've appeared in various places, so that might make a good floppy comic. But, you know, a floppy comic called The Man Who Loved Breath, its initial orders did pretty good.
Yeah.
And, you know, sex is going to sell, and I'm not sure the Indian fables are going to sell. So if they wanted to do another one, I would love to print those fables all together.
The man
but
who loved Ganesh.
Know. The man who loved what? Oh,
Ganesh.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I just don't know if I would hate to have that go out and have them get the orders for, like, you know, 136 or something like that.
I can already see the cover with, like, Ganesh sitting at the coffee bar, you know?
So I don't have any other plans to do another floppy one. I would love to someday have my own ongoing comic, sort of like, like 8-Ball or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I need to do that when I can do it full-time.
Yeah.
It would come out every 2 years at this point. So.
So no graphic novel sitting in your back pocket you're stewing on?
Yeah, I have one, but I just don't know. I've had one, actually. In Odin, there's my story called The Story of Horse.
Yeah.
That one has continued to percolate in my head since I did it, and I want to do a long graphic novel of it, but it would take... I'm not the fastest guy in the world. It would take a long time, and I'm not sure that has a lot of commercial potential either. It's a story about a horse who eventually sails to Israel, so it doesn't exactly have an easy hook. I desperately want to do it, and it's finding the time, and I thought about, well, maybe I could possibly serialize it, maybe they'd want to put it in Moam, but I also need to make sure that I could do it so a new chapter comes out every quarter.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to be in a position where, oh, every chapter's coming out in a year, that would be terrible. So it's really finding the time to get enough of it ready. And that's just the ongoing dilemma of my life, sadly. So I think for the meantime, I try to work on smaller things that I can get done and get out in the world so I don't disappear completely from view, and then hope for some sort of good fortune that would come that would allow me to work on something longer where I could disappear for a little while and have this come out. But it's just, how do I make money? It's a
terrible catch-22.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. But not uncommon in comics.
Tell me about your work with wood, because I love the flyer you sent me for The Man Who Loved Brass that was done on wood, and I showed it to my girlfriend. She was just blown away by it.
Oh, cool. Glad she liked it. Glad you liked it. How did that start? I like wood. I think it started with... I started making... At comic conventions, I would go to these conventions to sort of promote myself, get out there a little bit, sell my comics, but I would go there and not make any money. It would be a disaster. And I would be there with these $2 comics, and I would sell a few of them, and I would barely pay for the table. It was very depressing. And so I thought I needed to do something that would make a little bit more money. So I came up with this idea. I made one for myself initially of a sketchbook made out of plywood so that with rings on it, so that the paper would lay flat. Like when they're bound, the paper, when you lay it out, it folds over. And when I use a brush, that makes a difference. I need my paper to lay flat so that the pressure is the same over the page.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a little finicky thing, but it's just as important for somebody who uses a brush pen. And also, being plywood, you could set it anywhere. It's not going to be soft. I could take it anywhere and draw. So it worked out really well for me. I thought it might work out well for other people. So I started to silkscreen images on them and sell them at shows, and they did pretty well. And then from that, a person who makes wooden postcards found me, and she licensed some of my designs. And so I was doing some stuff from her for a while, and that relationship soured. That did not go well, which is unfortunate, because I would love to do licensed stuff for people.
Mm-hmm.
But she kind of did me wrong a little bit. So fortunately, I only licensed stuff for her for a year. That contract ran out, and I went out and did it on my own.
Yeah.
And once I learned how to do it on my own, I thought it would be a great promotional thing for my comic to send it out to stores, because I think I'm still very, very much unknown to the general comic world. And I thought I'll send these little postcards out there, get their attention, and help the sales with Diamond. So I made a bunch of them, but they didn't quite get out to the stores. So I have a bunch. But fortunately, with Breath in the title, the sales from Diamond was still strong. But yeah, I really love wood. My blog is called The Wood Paneled Basement. Someday I dream about having a wood paneled basement.
Shag carpeting?
Yeah, that would be great.
Orange, really bright orange.
Very, that would be sweet. Cleaning it.
Not so sweet.
Not have it wall to wall, but yeah, that would be really nice. I'm surprised that shag carpeting has not come back in a big way in places.
I had a wood paneled basement at one point, and it was hell to put things up because nothing would stick to it.
Where I was working, my office mate and I put wood paneling on it, and it immediately made things very cozy. I liked it.
Good.
So, yeah, I really like wood. I would love to someday do a comic with a wood cover like that. I don't think it would be very difficult if the print run was small enough, and I wonder if it would be that expensive. I don't think it would be.
I have no idea.
So maybe someday. That would be really great.
That would be fabulous. I would love to see something like that.
I wonder if I could do a floppy that way. I think I could. Without the cost being too high. Something to look into.
Eat that, Fort Thunder. We're making comics out of wood.
That would be the greatest. I would love to do an entire silkscreen book with a wood cover. But I can't. That's another dream. There's a publisher in Switzerland that used to do entirely silkscreen books called Drosophile, and they had an anthology, and that was all silkscreened, and they would have...
That must have been pricey.
I'm sorry?
That must have been pricey.
It was a little bit. I forget. I think because I was dealing with another currency, I was never really aware of how much I was spending. I think it was a bit, but he wasn't doing it all by hand. He did have... some kind of machine that would make the process go faster. But it was people like... Do you know Frederick Peters?
No.
He had a book...
Sounds familiar.
He had a book called Blue Pills that I think got very little press, but it was very good. And I'm going to butcher his name, Helge Ruhmann, who's part of that Elvis Studios.
Oh, okay, yeah.
He would be in there. Just fantastic stuff. And silkscreened, and that was amazing. Amazing, amazing book. So, yeah, someday I would love to do an all-silkscreen book, but these are all dreams.
Momentary pipe dreams.
Yeah.
No, it would be. Yeah. I would love to see a wood cover book. I think, because back in the 80s, like I'm really into weird, noisy industrial music, and this one band, Soviet France, they did one record that was with like this really thin, like onion skin, like paper as the cover. Another with roofing tiles.
Wow.
And just like craziest shit. So I think it would be really neat to see some comics folks fuck around and try something a little odd and a little new.
I am a total like print fetishist. There's a magazine called Visionaire. Have you ever seen that?
No.
I don't know when it comes out. It might be like a quarterly or whenever they get it together. But like per issue, it might be $200 or $300. I've gotten when I was single and had disposable income. I bought a few issues, and they get people like editors from the fashion world of like Philippe Starck once designed the casing of one of their issues, or God, now I'm trying to think of them, and of course they just escape my head. But a lot of fashion photographers and people like that will get together, and they're crazy. They're totally over the top, and they're amazing. And I, you know, that's the kind of stuff I would spend money on if I was really wealthy, but I have a few, and that's it.
Well, I'm really excited.
I would love. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I would love to do stuff like that. I love it. Occasionally, I've seen things like that. There is I have a Dupuy Babarian silkscreened book on like beautiful watercolor paper that a guy did. There's a publisher in France that does these things. And I think those guys, they do illustrations for a wine label. I think it's a wine label or it's a wine store. And they're beautiful. And he put them out to get out on this thing. And they're all silk screened in about two or three colors. Gorgeous.
Oh.
And they are always a little bit pricey. But I think if I can ever get to a point where I have a bit more clout or I can ask for things like that. One thing I would really like to do is, if I do an ongoing magazine, is to print stuff on hemp paper just for environmental reasons.
Yeah.
I would like to see people try that. I think the problem is that it's still expensive. Not enough people are using it. But, you know, if it's in kind of an art thing where people are used to paying a little bit more, maybe that would be the start. But yeah, I love it. I'm with you on that.
One thing I'm kind of excited about is Jacob Covey, or Cavi, for Fantagraphics. He's doing the Beast book. The second one's coming out next month, and he's doing an art show for it. And all the prints, no Geesley prints or Geesley, none of those. Not allowed. And it's all got to be like someone's got to use their hands in making it. So, like letter print.
Wow. I think that's a great idea. Yeah. I one of the books that we published for Robot. Well, the cover of Odin, one of the artists, Joy Kalitsky, would do a lot of etchings.
Mm-hmm.
And so she did comics that she etched. She did the cover, and then the inside, she did a story. But without a full understanding of the printing process, we tried an experiment where it was scanned as line art, and it was scanned as grayscale. And the two images were put over each other, and one was printed one color, one was printed the other color. And on the cover, it worked beautifully. On the interior pages, it became a muddy mess. But then we printed it. When I did another story of hers called In the Sea, which was one of our small books, and again she etched it. And this time I had learned about duotones. And we printed that story in black and metallic green, and it was beautiful. I was really happy with it. So yeah, again, printing, etching.
Print nerd.
Oh, there's a guy in France named Jay who also does etchings in comics, and they're amazing, and they have a very medieval sort of influence to them, and they're really, really creepy. I have two of his books, and they're silent. I think with how bad the dollar has been doing, less and less stuff is even getting imported. Like, that's something that you could totally buy here, but it would just be too costly. But he's one to check out if anybody wants to Google him. It's C-O-C-H-E. He's really great.
And
where's that show going to be? Where's the Beast Show at? Is it in Seattle?
Yeah, it's going to be at the shop, at the Fantagraphics store. Yeah, it's going to be a whole party. Their second year anniversary of the store being open, and Pete Bagg's new band will be playing. And so I'm actually going to make the trek down and get drunk on the Fantagraphic dollar, because they usually have free booze. So that's how I like to roll.
I think I saw one of those prints on their blog by Nicholas Mahler.
Yeah, the Silkscreen.
That was really
one.
Great.
Yeah, good stuff.
It looked
stuff.
Like it might have been Silkscreen.
So, if people want to check out your stuff, where would be the best place to go?
The best place would be my website, which is my name, robertgoodin.com.
Spelt how it sounds.
Yeah, G-O-O-D-I-N, not Dwight Gooden was E-N.
Yeah.
But I'm I-N.
Not Godin, but Gooden.
Yes. And the comic can be ordered at my website. It can also be ordered at the Top Shelf website, and then you can get a lot of other great Top Shelf stuff.
And it's called The Man Who Loved Breasts.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have a blog you can get to through my website. And I've got a lot of stuff on there. A few comics. They're a little bit old. So, yeah, people could check that out.
Excellent. Well, they're all fabulous. I love all the stuff, so it doesn't matter if they're old. They're still good. So,
thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Robert.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.